At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Financial crises, past and possibly future, on the broadcast today. Also, another stroll down the street of eternal happiness in Shanghai. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 24th of January. Glad you could be with us. As the seemingly irrepressible stock market keeps on telling us, the financial crisis is over. Five-year highs, anybody in the markets? But worries about the next crisis are never very far away, as you know, which gets us to the acronymical tag team of the SEC and the CFPB. Today, the president nominated former federal prosecutor Mary Jo White to chair the first and renominated Richard Cordray to run the second. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gets us up to speed.
If she's confirmed by Congress, Mary Jo White would be the first prosecutor to ever head the SEC. Her nomination sends a strong message, says Georgetown law professor Donald Langbord.
This is a name that everybody knows. She is a very tough, aggressive person, and I think that's meant to send a signal about the work of the commission.
The SEC has gotten flack for everything from missing Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme and the symptoms of the financial crisis to the way it penalized financial institutions involved in the crisis.
This kind of the toll gate that we see has been operating for some time.
James Cox is a professor of securities law at Duke University.
SEC files an action against only the company, doesn't file an action against the individual necessarily. It collects some money so that the sanction is only a cost of doing business and has no real deterrent effect at all.
Cox says someone like Mary Jo White could be a good antidote. As the SEC struggles to spruce up its reputation, the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is trying to live up to its reputation. Richard Cordray has been renominated to lead the bureau, which has made a strong start, says securities regulation expert John Coffey.
And I think it's being very effectively run. They're seeing it take a very activist stance on issues like mortgage protection.
Not to mention credit card fees and payday loans. Ironically, Cordray may have a tougher time than Mary Jo White getting confirmed. Last time around, Republicans vowed to blackball him, and President Obama had to appoint him during a Senate recess. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Pentagon made it official today, lifting its ban on women in combat, which could make it easier for women to eventually get some of the top jobs in the armed services. We wondered whether there might be a corporate analogy. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
Here's a little advice to all you women out there in corporate America.
Manage lots of money. Not lots of people.
Harvard Business School professor Rosebeth Moss Cantor says women in finance, tech, or any other sector must avoid the P's, personnel, public relations, purchasing. Cantor says you gotta go where the action is.
This is why women in combat is so important. If you're restricted from the heart of what the enterprise does, You'll never get to the top.
And you need to be in the spotlight, managing money, taking risks, and innovating. Bob Damon, a senior executive of Korn Ferry, a global search firm, says you can't be top dog without proving you're up to it.
You have to put yourself in roles that give you experience on the firing line.
Catch that? Firing line. Just like there are lots of women in the military, the ranks of Fortune 500 companies are filled with female workers. But they still make up a very small minority at the top, says Debbie Soon. Soon's with Catalyst, a nonprofit advocacy group for women in business. She says what women could really use is more women who are higher up the corporate chain to help them.
People who are in a high enough position to influence the kind of jobs that you get, the opportunities that you get, who will personally vouch for you and even sometimes make those opportunities happen.
Without that support, Soon says it'll be hard for women to rise up the ranks. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a breather from the rally. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've heard it once, you've heard it a million times. In tech today, it's all about mobile, mobile, mobile. It's been a big winner for some, Apple and Google. You know the cast of characters as well as I do. But just as there are winners, so too are there losers. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
To understand what's happening to the desktop market, you have to meet my friend John Song.
Hi, my name is John Song. I manage a family import business in the greater Los Angeles area.
John's married and has two kids.
Nathan, he's 10, and Audrey, she's 8.
And how many desktop computers do you have?
We have one desktop. Everything else is pretty small and mobile.
John says that his family is online a lot, but his wife surfs the web on an iPad, and his kids?
The kids, they don't have their own computers, but they've inherited our old iPhones, and they work fine in terms of getting onto the internet.
John's family is typical of the shift that's happening in wired households across the U.S. And that shift, plus a depressed global economy, delivered a blow to PC shipments last year. Mika Kitagawa is an analyst at Gartner, and she says the overall market was down 3.5% last year,
which was the first decline since 2002.
So it's the first decline in 10 years?
Yeah.
That drop has set off a chain reaction. Acer and HP, two of the world's largest PC manufacturers, are struggling. And Kitagawa says Dell's computer shipments were down 20% in the last quarter. That sent Dell's stock down so far that founder Michael Dell is trying to take the company private in an effort to reinvent it. And the pain doesn't stop there. Joanne Feeney is a semiconductor analyst at Longbow Research. She says chip makers like Intel and AMD have been hit too.
Both Intel and AMD have found themselves out in the cold. Neither of them has had products that have been tuned to the specific needs of tablets.
But they're working on that. And Feeney says that while the PC market is down, it's nowhere near out. There is, after all, the rest of the world. China just surpassed the U.S. as the world's largest desktop market. And Feeney says businesses in the developing world still have a lot of buying to do. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Hard as this may be to process, we are not all that far from the fifth anniversary of the bailout of Bear Stearns, March of this year to be precise. That also means we're not far from the fifth anniversary of the death of Lehman Brothers and the whole nightmare that was the end of 2008. A lot has been written about it, a lot of analysis has been done, and a lot of blame has been thrown. Alan Blinder, though, best known as an economist at Princeton, but also a former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, says in his new book, After the Music Stopped, that not enough credit has been given. Alan Blinder, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
This crisis brought with it a fundamental intervention of the government in the economy with the TARP and the Fed and the bailouts and all of that. And one of the key points you make in this book is that you don't believe necessarily the government has gotten the credit for saving things, for saving the world, basically.
Right. In fact, it's worse than that. I think the government's taken a lot of blame for how bad the crisis was. Now, some of it was deserved. That said, history will, I am confident, be written, and I'm starting it in this book.
If you say so yourself.
By declaring that the stimulus, that the TARP, and that the bank stress tests were enormously successful government interventions that saved us from what could have been a much worse fate.
But I think you have to admit, and you do a bit in this book, that the government was inconstant in its actions. It was herky-jerky. It was fits and starts. It was, hey, this didn't work. Let's try this. You know, there was a lot of, you know, backing and forthing and toing and froing.
Yeah, there was, especially early on. Now, some of that's forgivable since things are coming at these guys from all different directions that they've never seen before. These guys at that time were mainly Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and Ben Bernanke. And there was this inconstancy. The thing that I complain about most in the book was the rank discrepancy between the treatment of Bear Stearns in March 2008 and Lehman Brothers in September 2008. After Bear Stearns, it was a reasonable supposition that Lehman Brothers, being in the same business and almost twice the size of Bear, would get a similar fate. Mm-hmm. Instead, it was CU in bankruptcy court. That was really – well, I don't want to say the straw that broke the camel's back. That was like another camel falling on the camel's back. I mean, it broke everything.
I can't let you go without asking you about a professional and academic colleague of yours, the guy who is now arguably running the American economy, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed. What do you think of what the Fed has done so far? And more important, how much more can it do if Congress continues to dither?
If I interpret your question as starting sometime after Lehman,
plus or minus,
I've already said,
I
think the handling of Lehman was a mistake. And Ben Bernanke knows that. I think that we've discussed it. But after that, the Fed has just done superbly. It's been imaginative and smart. Now, all that said, once you get interest rates, short-term interest rates, down to about zero, and we've been there since December 2008, the Fed starts pulling weaker and weaker weapons out of the armory.
Which is funny because everybody's expecting stronger and stronger stuff from the Fed.
Yeah, but, you know, they shouldn't. And Ben Bernanke and his colleagues at the Fed know that this is so. So I'm with Bernanke on the attitude, well, if all I've got is slingshots and pea shooters to fight the enemy, I'm shooting them. But realistically, the Fed just doesn't have the heavy artillery that it once had and will have again once we normalize things, but it doesn't have it now.
Alan Blinder, he's a professor of economics at Princeton University. He's got a new book out. It's called After the Music Stopped. Professor Blinder, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, you want to know why they're so happy on the street of eternal happiness?
Chinese people in their 30s have grown up in an economy that has grown faster than any other in modern history.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here we go. The Dow Industrial stepped up 46 points today, about a 3%, finished at 13,825. The NASDAQ felt the Apple effect, though, dropped 23 points, 0.75%, wrapped up at 3130. The S&P 500 flat at 1494. Apple sliced off another 12% today on doubts about whether it can keep up its pace of growth. Netflix soared past expectations, scored 42% higher. I got carried away there. Amazon rose 2%. eBay bid up its stock 3.33% today. Xerox beat expectations, tacked on 2.25%. Bed Bath & Beyond plumped up more than 4% today. UPS traveled up 2.25%. Trucking and logistics company Swift Transportation sped up 28%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.85%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for December. For foodies and foragers, the Oregon Truffle Festival gets underway in Eugene. And on January 25, 1945, Grand Rapids, Michigan started fighting tooth decay in a new way, becoming the first U.S. city to add fluoride to the water supply. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lockheed Martin, the Pentagon's top contractor, acknowledged just a bit of the obvious in its earnings report today. Tough times, they are a-coming in the national security space. Sales, the company said, are going to be down this year. Raytheon said pretty much the same thing this morning, as did General Dynamics yesterday, all of which bodes ill for the formerly recession-proof Washington, D.C. economy. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Piggybacking on defense and other federal spending, D.C. has outpaced the national economy for a decade. It sure helps that government spending almost tripled, says Stephen Fuller at George Mason University.
We're used to having a 2 percentage point margin between the Washington area and the national economy. We have been a high flyer here the last 12 years.
Now the erosion starts. The debt ceiling deal 2 years ago whacked $1 trillion in spending, more than a third out of the DOD. Today, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon both forecast that contracting will decline more. Byron Callen is a defense analyst at Capital Alpha Partners.
There's a strong consensus that it's going to go down. I think, you know, the question, does it go down taking the stairs or does it go down taking the elevator? Sequestration would be the equivalent of taking the express elevator down.
There's that word again, sequestration. Mandatory budget cuts will happen if Congress and the White House can't reach a spending deal. But even if they do, Michael Cassidy thinks Pentagon contracts will shrink the way they did in the early 90s. He's with a think tank called the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis.
You had a significant drawdown in defense resources at the end of the Cold War. Now we're talking about a significant drawdown due to the ending of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Fuller at George Mason thinks the D.C. metro economy will grow a pedestrian 2.5 or 3% this year, just a hair faster than the rest of the country. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A story now about the National Football League and intellectual property. The San Francisco 49ers will be playing in the Super Bowl in a couple of weeks, in no small part because of the talents of their young quarterback, Colin Kaepernick. If you've seen him play, you've also likely seen him score and then pantomime kissing his flexed right bicep. Well, it turns out the 25-year-old Kaepernick calls this move Kaepernicking, and I am sadly not making this up. He has applied to trademark it. Marketplace's Jim Burris has that story.
First, there was Tebowing, then Lensanity, now Kaepernicking.
Kaepernick dropping deep, throws to the end zone, caught, touchdown.
Tim Tebow and Jeremy Lin trademarked their respective terms, but it's not clear how much they've made off them, nor how much Kaepernick stands to make. Daniel Durbin teaches sports and culture at the University of Southern California. He questions the timing of the trademark move. He says Kaepernick should be focused on the big game.
This quarterback is focused on trying to copyright an action of self-love.
Durbin says the danger for Kaepernick is sports stars and their brands often fade quickly. Who even says Linsanity anymore? But Laura Heyman says a trademark is sometimes less about protecting a brand and more about protecting the person behind it. She teaches law at William & Mary.
If anybody's going to be able to make money from merchandise that involves that mark, it should be the athlete himself or herself.
My question, why pigeonhole these trademarks to sports figures? Why not public radio? If so, this story just got burrist. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
The World Economic Forum rages on in Davos, Switzerland. We brought you the voices of some of the skeptics yesterday. Today, a proponent of that confab, in part, perhaps, because he has a free place to stay just about anywhere in the world he goes. Chris Nassetta is the CEO of Hilton Worldwide. We got him up in Davos. Chris, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Kai.
Talk to me for a second about the world, part of the World Economic Forum. You guys are expanding mostly overseas. 60-something percent of your growth is overseas. Is that because you think you've saturated the American market, or is that honestly where all the opportunity is for you?
I don't think we're saturated in the U.S. You know, my objective is really to be able to serve all of our customers with any need they have anywhere in the world they may have it. And it's, as it so happens, we are underserving them outside the U.S.
One of the other things you're doing up there in Davos, I gather, is trying to get support for some youth employment initiatives you're working
Absolutely.
On. Absolutely. Explain that a little bit, because while certainly travel and tourism is a place where you can get an entry-level job, how do you grow? Where does it? What's the professional development chain there?
I mean, the reality is many of us in this industry have made careers of it. I myself started in the engineering department, basically plunging toilets was my first job, and that's a
and
true story.
And look at you now.
And I run the largest lodging company in the world. So, you know, and many tens of thousands of our team members around the world have started their careers at the lowest levels of this business and have managed to work their way up. We, you know, it's one of the things that we're trying to do as part of this effort is really educate people that these are good jobs. And this is a place you can start, and we spend tens of millions of dollars a year training our people.
Well, sorry. So if I'm a 22-year-old Chinese kid in Chengdu out in Sichuan province, and I've just gotten out of college, and I don't want to work in some, technology company, give me the recruiting fair sales pitch.
We're a very complex business. We're everything. I mean, if you're interested in accounting, finance, tax, development, construction, marketing, the online space. I mean, you think about it, every one of those and 100 other things we do every day to make this business work and ultimately, you know, do what we do best, which is we're all here to serve customers, right, and create exceptional experiences.
Let me get back to Davos for just a second and the getaway for the rich and famous that it sort of has become. Are you doing anything there that you could not do at some other meeting someplace else?
I would say, yeah. I mean, I have probably my top 30 customers in the world are here, all in one place at one time. The ministers of tourism and finance for every major economy and other economies that we're active in around the world, it really is just a platform here in Davos that has a lot more legs than most other places in my experience.
Where are you staying? Is there a Hilton in Davos?
I'm staying at the Hilton Garden Inn Davos, brand new. So I encourage everybody when you're in Davos, Hilton Garden Inn.
There you go. Chris Nassetta, he's the CEO of Hilton Worldwide. Chris, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. Great being with you.
The economic word out of Beijing the other day was promising a growth rate of 7.8% last year. Practically mind-blowing for us. For the Chinese, though, the slowest growth since 1999. And a reminder that in China, people under the age of 30 or 35 haven't really been through an economic downturn. Our correspondent Rob Schmitz in Shanghai has been working on a series the past year or so about the Chinese economy, the people, and the places that make it work. They are stories from a single street in that city of Shanghai called the Street of Eternal Happiness. Today, China's 30-somethings.
On the Street of Eternal Happiness, number 810, sounds of a distant revolution spill out of a sandwich shop. Chen Kai plays a rousing rendition of the revolutionary song Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy on his accordion. It's an old Communist Party song from his parents' generation. He was forced to learn it as a schoolboy in the 1980s. To him, it means nothing. Chen's generation, Chinese people in their 30s, have grown up in an economy that has grown faster than any other in modern history. They have almost nothing in common with their parents.
My parents grew up in the 1950s during a famine. Sometimes they couldn't even afford to eat. In the 60s and 70s, the government forced them to work as farmers in the countryside. When they went back to the city, they were sent to work in the factories.
Chen's childhood couldn't have been more different. He grew up middle class in an industrial city in Hunan province in the 1980s, a time when Western products and ideas flowed into China for the first time.
It was a beautiful and innocent age. It was sort of like America in the 1960s, but without the free love or drugs. We were becoming more open-minded.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
As an aspiring musician, Chen grew up listening to Western groups like Simon and Garfunkel and The Doors. Today, the sound of silence is still a favorite in China's karaoke bars. For Chen's generation, the song conjures up memories not of the 1960s, but the 1980s, which culminated in the student-led protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots. Heading down the road was a communist
witness. The message from China's government to Chen's generation was clear. You're free to make money and help build China's economy. Just don't challenge our authority. So with nothing but his accordion and a college degree, Chen reluctantly followed his father's advice and found a job at a state-owned factory where he assembled accordions. He lasted 3 years before he quit.
My father was very angry with me. He kept calling me. He'd say, "You can't just resign like that. You're a manager of a state-owned company. This is the Iron Rice Bowl." I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew it wasn't this.
Chen had pulled a luozi, Chinese for naked resignation, quitting a job without first securing another one. More and more urban professionals of Chen's age are doing this. In economic terms, Chen belongs to China's sandwich generation, middle-aged adults who have to provide for their children and their parents. The pressure of being stuck in the middle is intensified for Chen's generation, those who were born under China's one-child policy and don't have any siblings. Li Zixing runs the Chinese website called China 30s, a popular forum for China's sandwich generation.
More than anything, our parents want us to have a stable job. Their generation was thrown out to sea without learning to swim. They don't realize that not only do we know how to swim, but we enjoy it, and we don't need them to throw us a life preserver.
But Li admits the waters of China's economy can make for dangerous swimming.
Those of our generation from the countryside aren't satisfied with being a tiny cog in a huge labor market. I think this can be dangerous because they just end up hanging around.
At the sandwich shop on the Street of Eternal Happiness, Chen Kai rests with his accordion on his lap. It may look like he's hanging around, but no. This member of China's sandwich generation owns the sandwich shop. He opened it with a friend a half a year ago.
Business is okay, but we really believe in what we're doing, and at some point, we'll have success.
Before the lunch rush hits, Chen plays another song. This one's not revolutionary. It's just a little piece he wrote after he quit his job a few years ago. And now, here he is, at his shop on the Street of Eternal Happiness, with an instrument his father pushed him to learn. His government taught him to build, playing a song he created. And sure, it's not as polished as the communist songs he memorized as a child, but this one is from his heart. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The web version of Rob's series, The Street of Eternal Happiness, is at our homepage. Videos, interactive maps, and more. Marketplace.org is the address.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which comes as Treasury Secretary-designate Jack Lew started his round of get-to-know-you meetings on Capitol Hill today. The Jewish Daily Forward newspaper recounts that Lew was once asked to serve as the treasurer at his local synagogue. Turned it down with a smile, the story goes, saying synagogue finances would be harder to manage than the federal budget. So there you go. All right, that's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.